doors opening, step back so customers may exit. When boarding, move to the center of the car.
I thought the doors were closing.
I'll be later after the meeting. Is that Dan throwing his voice?
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Chair is not here yet. I'm sure he's on the way, so we're going to get started. And I believe we have the form. I think it's okay, great. Then we have the minutes from our meeting of January 5.
Move approval.
We have a motion. Can I have a second?
Second.
And a second. And without exception, then the minutes will be adopted. All right. Let's. Since we're expecting other members, we had made a commitment that we were going to start with the action items, but let's start with the information items and wait for a few members to come. And so we'll get the semi-annual status report on railcar programs.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chairman, our chief engineer, Dan Hannon, and our project manager, Mr. Jeff Prigoli, will take you through the semi-annual update on our railcar performance. Dan?
Thank you,
ma'am.
Jeff?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here.
Welcome.
We're moving forward. We are pleased, obviously, to be here today to report some good things, and we'll be going through that in a minute. To my right is Jeff Pringle, our Senior Project Manager, who will be reporting on the bulk of our railcar programs. But before we start that, I'd just like to say that Takis has given us a great challenge to help build a world-class engineering organization here, and I believe we're making some great progress, and you're going to hear about some of those things today. We have five key programs that we're working on. We'll be walking through each one of those programs. We'll be looking at our other railcar programs in addition to that, which include the Anacostia streetcar, precision stopping, the 1000 series improvements, rail car capacity, of course, which you've all been presented, had a presentation on previously, and some look aheads with some exciting opportunities that we'll be presenting. These are the five key programs that we're currently focusing on, and Jeff will be talking about each one of those in just a moment. Next slide. I think you've all seen this slide before. It provides you a listing of the fleet as it currently exists and as it's projected as the 6000 series is completed and rolled out. What's important, I think, is to really focus on the four primary programs that we have with one contractor, Alstom. They handle the 2K, 3K rehab. They are the manufacturer of the new 6000 series car. They're handling our ATC, our train control system for the 5K, and they are deeply involved with us on precision stopping. It's a very, very important relationship that we've been developing and maturing over the last several years, and I have to say since I've joined the authority, the relationship has substantially improved, primarily driven, I think, by Takis's direct involvement in partnering with Alstom. There's been, as you know, I think, a management change at Alstom, which has increased their availability to us and productivity. We see a lot of good things happening in Hornell, New York, quite frankly. And there's a statement in there which you can read from the president of the company assuring us that this is the most important contract that they have available to them right now and guaranteeing that their performance will be within the scope of the contract. So we're very pleased with that relationship that we've been building over the last several months, certainly improved relationship. The obvious focus here is to make sure that they meet their deliverables and their obligations under the contract.
Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
The 5000 series cars, they are the ones produced by CAF, They've been in service now since June of 2004, and we've continued to see improvements with the metric we call MDVD. We've had, I think, the past 6 months, reliability has improved on these cars. And that really was expected with the modifications that have been completing during that process. There's a handful of EMIs, as we call those, modifications that have to happen yet. The one modification that is that will be significant will be the door controls, and that would be probably the last modification for us to keep this car on this track of improving its reliability.
Madam Chairman, a point to make there is that the doors continue to be a problem for us. 70% of the delays was due to the door opening and closing of those cars. And the moment we get them under control, those cars, they have all the potential to really give us a lot of good mileage.
You can see on this chart, for example, the line is indicating 72,006. That is the goal for the new car fleets. And as you can see, in early in the summer, late in the summer, we were well below that line. We had a forecast that we reported to you in the past. And as you can see how the blue line indicates, we actually tracked. We did cross over in December the way we were forecasting. We were very happy with that. We've actually continued that track. And the remaining modifications, I believe, will keep us above that line, and that's our goal. The 2-3000 series, in the past, you've heard us discuss this as a tough program. Takis had mentioned that many times, as well as us that are on the programs, and it was true. Our focus with Alstom, who's the car builder on the rehab, coming really out of the results of our executive partnering and a lot of the meetings we've had with the engineers, what we're seeing now is continuous improvement on the same thing, MDVD. The last 6 months, this fleet of 160-some-odd cars now has improved and actually passed the goal that we've had. In this slide, you'll see the same thing.
Madam Chair, the point to be made here is our 2,000 series cars, which is the oldest after the 1,000, it's all done rehab, but they're performing nicely. And you can see it. And now they're making the progress on the 3,000. But the good news is the worst performers have been rehabbed.
Right. So we expect that our reliability will continue to improve. We did a campaign, as we call it, on 142 of the earlier cars that were rehabbed down at our Branch Avenue facility. That was over in about 2.5 months, and the result was a lot of the modifications that were necessary were completed in that period. Now we're going to see some steady improvement, and we really want to keep the reliability around that line, if not above that line. And it looks like we're on that way of doing that. We expect approximately 260 cars by the year end on that program. The 6,000 series, of course, is our newest fleet, and it's been again produced by the Alstom facility in Hornell, New York. It really recently started in pre-revenue testing. On the 27th of February, we introduced the first cars in a between-rush type of a format. We now have 12 cars at our facility, and we're continuing to run some pre-revenue tests and finishing some safety testing. We expect to go into this pre-revenue with an 8-pack very soon. On the screen, you'll see some of the photos that we've had. The two on the top, of course, are the interior with the new improved interior for egress. The biggest change is the overhead double rail. And, of course, on the backs of the seats now we have the seat back to the rail above. Those stanchions are now on every chair except for the quad. That's because the quad is a tilt seat for maintenance to get to the equipment. Also, you see the addition of the side rails, and we opened up this area. This is the center door. We've opened this up for the location for the handicap, as well as improving with the railing and this new call station. That's something new in this car. This is the first car that's going to have call stations at the center door. And it's in the proper location for the handicap access. So It was well thought out. This sign here, we placed on the windows on these cars during pre-revenue test, more to indicate to the public on the platforms not to board. We're testing this car, and we're all very excited about what we're seeing so far. This slide is simply showing the reliability for the programs, and you can see the improvement that we've made between January 05, the average, to January 06. The MDBD, mean distance between delays, has greatly improved. You can notice each fleet is out there. Of course, there will not be a 6,000 until we have enough cars to start reporting on.
Madam Chair, just to bring your attention, look at the 5,000 series. Last January, yeah, we were 33,000 between failures, and today we are 87. This is an increase of something like 160% or so.
Yeah, and the other one would be this.
And this one, the old cars, I was telling you before, they used to do 22,697. And today we do 66. This is 200% increase. For that, we are on the way there. And after we get these goals, we need to really focus to keep them. And that's the big thing.
That is very impressive in just 1 year to see that kind of improvement.
Can I add one thing? What this does highlight, though, is the older fleet, the Roar car fleet, the 1000s. And that represents a longer-term issue that we're going to have to work together on to see that number doesn't continue to get worse.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah, brief
Mr. Kaufman.
Yeah, just tying on with Dan's comments, when you have a quarter of your fleet is around when Vegas were around, that's saying something.
Madam Chair, Fritha Mitchell is our project manager for the precision stopping, which some of you heard a lot of things. So I'd like your couple minutes to tell you where we are with this program.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. How are you?
Great, thank you. The 8-car precision station stopping program, phase one, was successfully completed in December of 05 on the red line. And we are now working towards the orange line and the green line. Lots of crowding on the orange line, lots of crowding on the green line. We will implement both lines in parallel at the same time, and expect to see great results on that. As you will see, the milestones on the slide, between March and April, the 1000 and the 5000 series cars will be outfitted for the red line. Then in July and August, we will outfit the other fleets for the green and orange lines. And then at the end of this year, we will complete the blue and orange lines. So we expect the entire program to be completed by December of 06.
Madam Chair, a couple highlights here for you and the board is we added three enhancements. After you approved the final phase of this program on January 19th, we added three enhancements. The market for it, login diagnostics. In case something happens, let's say the night before due maintenance and the coils have been relocated, the diagnostics on the onboard equipment of our rail cars, it will give us location. Cab signals, lagging function, that is when sometimes the speed command on the rail car, they go to zero, that will give us an advanced diagnostic. And if the door, let's say the car overshoots the platform, to know, allow the doors to open. That Alstom came through with these three new engineering enhancements, working with our staff. You authorized it on January 19th, and we are on the way. Not only are we going to get precision stopping, but we're getting three additional enhancements for the price and the budget we had planned all along for this project.
Thank you. Thank you.
The Anacostia streetcar project is moving along well. Personally, I'm very excited about this. In another life, when I was city engineer in Ann Arbor, Michigan, I tried to reintroduce streetcars there unsuccessfully. So we're very excited about this program, and The cars are under fabrication in the Czech Republic, and we're moving forward as scheduled. The other rail car programs, which I mentioned earlier, are really designed to support some of the activities within the fleet, primarily on the Aurora cars. We have two significant programs there. One is the modernization of the HVAC, or the air conditioning system, on the cars. As you know from previous reports, we've had trouble with the contractor there, TTA. There is new ownership there. We've had several meetings with them, and we are very optimistic that we're going to move forward with that program.
Mr. Chairman, this is a contract. We continue to have a problem. That was a small minority firm. It was sold and bought a couple of times. They are new. The former owner bought them again. They are not performing very good. But guess what? There are not many options available to us in this particular area of HVAC systems to discuss. But just recently we met with the new owners of the company. They have proposed a plan to us. The plan looks reasonable, looks convincing, but we are under the process to evaluate the plan and see if we can make some headway here. Well, you might see me coming back and talk to you about this, but right now this contract is not really doing very well. And I'm sensitive to this, because this relates to 1,000 series cars, which is the oldest cars in the fleet. We have problems with these cars to begin with. This one should add another problem, which, you know, we could mitigate it. But unfortunately, it's not moving very well. But this is not good news here. But maybe something good will happen.
On the next item, we do have good news for you, though. I think Toshiba is performing quite well on the traction motor rewind. We've been very happy with the high quality of the product that we've been getting from them. And they are on schedule and within budget, so we're very pleased with that activity. With regard to rail car capacity, the board, as you know, approved the phase two of the rail car capacity, and the funds are available now to move forward with that. You can see the schedule there that we've laid out for you. Internally, we've developed a working group that will be closely aligned with our customer services division, as well as the appropriate representation from the RAC to move forward with that program. With regard to improvement areas, we mentioned working very closely with Alstom. We're going to continue to do that, obviously a primary focus for us. The expert reviews, which we've talked about in the past, are moving well. We have two additional ones to do. Our experience has been very, very good with that, and as you know, Caucus has introduced a peer review opportunity with APTA, which you're going to hear more about later, which we also think is a very positive move. Our staffing, which we've been working on, is now complete with the addition of our two new ACE for standards and configuration, as well as an assistant chief engineer for vehicles. Primarily, contractual closure is looking at the 5000 series contract or the CAF contract for later on in 2006.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have about 150 administrative items which I need to start getting into the board slowly as we're going to clean them up, because they're going back 3-4 years, you know, as the projects are involved. For that, I'm telling you that April, May, I will start bringing administrative items to the board, not to the committee, to close them out like we do on the typical construction contracts. This is some of the items I have in front of me. This is part of what I look ahead. And we finished, as you know, the new Carlton shop, the new shop. And
which is right there now. The old shop is here.
And we are moving on that. I think by March 31st, it's going to be in full occupancy. Well, I like to take the old one.
You have a better picture.
Yes, this is the new shop.
The new shop is back here, and this is the existing shop.
That existing shop had a lot of deficiencies, as you know, not enough capacity. So the new shop is all ready, and I understand by the end of this month, they should really start using the shop in all fronts. For that, what I would like to consider, to turn this facility to help us with capital rehab campaigns for our existing fleet. As we're growing older now, we have more than 1,100 cars fleet. We're following the same MO of infrastructure construction with our rail cars. What that is, maintenance, every day goes through the operations department, rehab program, and recapitalization. I'm thinking to use this facility for some of these campaigns we have underway, like the HVAC system I told you, or maybe if we have some break campaigns to do. Well, it's an idea which we're evaluating. The shop has a lot of problems. We need to look at it. We need to evaluate it. It's not that's the reason we did a new shop. But maybe there is an opportunity here to centralize, because now I do a lot of these capital rehab improvements to the rail cars in four different facilities. Because all of you know, our contract has extended warranty built in, which means we are not accepting the car before the car reaches into reliability. But the contractor, the subcontractor, always asks for time to get into our cars and work. For that, this might help us centralize where we do all this instead of having staff in three, four different yards and interface a lot with operations people and so on. But that's an idea I'm bringing in front of you. We're going to discuss it again as we're going on. The two other ideas which we are exploring is this, the 7,000 series. It's time to start thinking for the new order. The Dallas project is the catalyst for that because it's making progress now. I think within this year we're going to get the approval from the FDA to move on for design, contract, document preparation for the Dallas project, which is phase one, 64 cars, and phase two, another 64. For that, if everything goes, some people think that the Dallas will be built now as one project. This is 128 cars order. In addition to this, you have the 1,000 series replacement coming up between 09 and 15, and we have to make a decision on what we're going to do on the 4,000 series, which they're reaching the mid-year life expectancy. For that, we need to, staff and I, we're going to work on this. I work with FDA, I work with the DRPT people, you know, the Virginia people about Dallas. For that, I'm going to come back to you sometime in the early summer after I know what's going on with Dallas and tell you and discuss with you what approach we should take here for our rail cars. Our new general manager and I, we've been talking. I think I know exactly where he is going with this. For that, we have some issues. We have procedural issues with FDA to work on it. But I'm a strong proponent to go for multi-year rail car procurement. I don't know the multi-year, what number that is, 5, 10, it's 8. I know the difficulties from the FDA. You cannot have more than a 5-year contract. I know we have to upgrade our fleet management plan. But I do know our needs very well. Expansion, Dallas is coming. It's happening. I know the 1,000 series, they're having a lot of hiccups. You saw them. They are more than 30 years old, and we have a lot of problems. And I know the 4,000 series is next year. We need to consider what to do with the 4,000 series.
So if I can jump in, the idea is to replace our lumpy, every now and then, big procurements with a consistent, long-term replacement, recognizing that the railroad's been around for 30 years. We expect it to be around for at least another 30. And just recognizing that we have an ongoing responsibility to have a consistent replacement cycle for the rail cars. In a separate discussion, we'll talk to you about doing the same thing for the bus, so we're not buying big slugs of buses that then, you know, 12, 15 years from now, whoever gets to be the general manager at that point has to go and figure out how to replace 400 or 500 buses all at once. The idea is to recognize the ongoing nature of this concern and begin to build into our long-term financial plans and procurements the ongoing replacement of our assets.
You do have one big lump, though, coming up with which you referred to, and that's the 1,000 series cars, which our basic policy is to admit with mid-year overhaul to get something like 35 to 40 years of a rail car. But with the Bredas, we've been doing the mid-year, working on the second half of that. But the Aurora cars are getting to the point where you're at the end of it. They weren't necessarily the best cars anyway, and I mean, you can see this being the headache coming in the next several years as, what is that, 300-some rail car?
Yeah, 296, 300.
So, you know, you're looking at a significant problem if we don't figure out how we're going to...
And as you can see from the replacement. As you can see from the data, we have a headache right now with the Aurora car. It's not coming up. It's now. Yeah. The question, though, is do we have a policy where we can
we continue to, you know, create subsequent headaches, or do we start recognizing the ongoing nature and start building in a kind of a consistent, sustainable program that replaces things like the roar cars, that allows us to expand our fleet, or ideas like Dulles and perhaps even DWI, and begin to have kind of a consistent ongoing replacement rehab program. We know how much it is every year. We can budget towards it. We can build our staff resources.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Kaufman.
Just for comparability purposes, and I don't know whether you know the answer or not, in looking at our type of rail car, and I guess BART is the only proximate system out there, how old are their cars? And what are their, what type of replacement program do they have?
Sure. As far as BART?
Yeah, how old are their cars?
The BART car is similar. I mean, it's a two-door car. Ours is a three, and it's 10 feet shorter.
Hatchback, but, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, the thing I'm looking at is how old and what type of replacement program they have.
Actually, their cars were rehabbed. The earlier cars have already gone through a rehab some time ago. I don't know what they're doing for the future, but certainly 40 years is the maximum that you'll normally see out there. The interesting thing is that aluminum extruded car bodies were first introduced with the BART system and here. So we're really...
Did MARTA not use them?
Yes, they are, BART.
MARTA in Atlanta.
Atlanta has a stainless steel car. So it's a little different animal. Right, it's a stick-built type car. I mean, it looks similar, and that's about it.
Back to Mr. Kaufman. I know a little bit about BART, Mr. Kaufman. You know, we have the same network, almost the same network, 106 miles, but they have half the number of stations we have. So that the stops our cars do every day, they are at least twice the stops the BART cars do. So that is really wear and tear on our cars.
Not to mention the ridership, and not to brag, but and that ridership then, with the additional stopping, that's additional weight, additional stopping, that's additional wear and tear. But I think I know where you were going with that, that maybe that we could work with other transit properties if we look at a long-term rehab and replacement, that we could do it with them. There is a recent program on the West Coast where a number of transit properties got together for a long-term procurement of buses. They're doing it together. And Takis and I have already talked about looking at some of the other folks around us in this area and across the country, perhaps exploring a long-term contract with a number of other properties that has obvious other benefits associated with being able to transfer staff and knowledge.
So I can see it for buses. It's a little harder.
It's a lot harder for rail cars. The only other one is BART, and they have less doors than we do.
Yes, and different gauge. BART is a wide gauge.
It's not the same.
It's a different truck.
But Mr. Kaufman, your question was very intuitive, because last week I did get a call from their chief engineer who actually discussed with us a potential sharing of some information back and forth with regard to their current situation with their Aurora cars. So they are looking at this.
Okay. The other question I had, Mr. Chairman, just briefly. You know, every now and then the question of extruded aluminum versus a different structural makeup because of past collision questions, and we've always had, you know, it's kind of the argument of, well, yes, it'd be safer in this instance, but less safe in another instance. I presume we'd also stop and take a deep breath and take a look at that one more time, just so it doesn't get raised after the fact. Let's, looking forward, you know, decide, does extruded aluminum remain the key way that we want to go?
Thank you. We will. Okay. The last item I would like to share with you as part of our thinking process, and you heard me say that before, is I had a study going on to identify some locations which we can build a test track. I told you before, it's my professional recommendation to you that we need to have a test track. The railroad's very busy, and you can't get widows to test these cars, and then you have to find a spot which the cars have to go 75 miles per hour and then brake, because that's part of the test. There is not a lot of opportunities anymore. For that, I had a study going on in 12 sites, and they came up with two promising sites. One is New Calton to Landover, and the other is Greenbelt to College Park. I'd like to continue this study a little bit more with the staff and come back to you sometime, I would say June, July, working with Chuck Woodrow for the capital project, ask you to give me a little bit of authority to spend a little bit of money to do a preliminary engineering for me to put my arms around of what money we're talking here in case we want to do a test track. I gave you as part of this presentation on the next few pages my thinking process why we needed this agency to do a test track. And we used to have a test track. And New York, Chicago, and San Francisco, the other three major rail systems, they do have test track. New York, Larry Reuter, some of you remember Larry Reuter, he told me a month ago when I visited with him in New York, he insisted to his board to build a third track. As part of his new procurement, they bought 1,000 new car order for the next 5-10 years. He said he had to have a third track to do testing because there is no windows anymore you can test uninterrupted on the railroad. For that, New York, Chicago, San Francisco have it. In addition to this is we need to have a test track and we need to make a part of the maintenance procedure that when they put a new component to the car as part of the maintenance, go test it and have a QA officer say it's working, it's good, put it in service. Don't put it in service and then something didn't work, take it off service. I believe that it will increase the quality of our performance as an organization. It will be helpful to us. And of course I'm mindful that it will cost some money to build it. How that test track looks like, it's got to be at least 10,000 feet. It doesn't have to be a total tangent, but it has to be near tangent with some kind of an elevation in order to get to 75 miles per hour speed. And definitely I don't want you to have to go through to buy a new property. It has to be within our property. And we have to have enough space, some mock-up space to pretend like we have a station and the train is going to stop on the station and take off. That's why the third bullet there is mock-up platform. And of course, it has to meet the standard of minimum cost. That's what I'm looking. Hopefully, in a couple of months, I'll come back to you and tell you between the two locations where something like this can happen. And if it's feasible and you think we can do it, maybe we should try as we're going on and we combine it with our new procurement to have this thing going on. That completes my presentation, Mr. Sarpaz.
Mr. Dingin.
Caucus, one question. If you're going to centralize your rehab facility and your maintenance facility, is that where you want to put your test track?
It would be desirable, Mr. Dingin. It would be very desirable to not have to cross the cars from one line to the other. I don't know if we'll be able to do it. Thanks for the question. That's another thing we look. There is a nice flat spot between New Carlton station.
Jurisdiction.
There is a nice flat spot from New Carlton Station to some point south, but really then gets to some heavy structures there and some wetlands and so on. But we need to look at that thing altogether. I will take you through in a couple of months. And right, I agree. That's another thing we need to be mindful. Greenbelt versus New Carlton. That's
probably more detail than we need to get into today, but interesting issues for a future meeting.
Yeah.
Mr. Solomon.
Yeah, just a follow-up question. For the future meeting, they have to tell us how much land is required and whether Vermont already owns that land, if it's private, county, state land that's going to be affected in all of those issues.
When I asked my engineers to go through and explore the 12 sites, Mr. Solomon, one of the criteria was stay within the right-of-way what we own now. And in those two locations, the right-of-way for us is a little bit wider. It's where our fences are, and we have a little bit more space there. And there is a story and a little history why this is wider, just to put one more track there. But we are not going outside the fence.
Okay, great.
Within the fence.
All right. Thank you very much. Shall we go to action items?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Dave Couch and I, we have before you a vehicle or a mod or an instrument we like to have access to APTA to do expert reviews. But I'd like you to receive his presentation and why we need to do this. And
before you do that, can we do it?
Yes.
You did not?
Yep.
All right. Go ahead. Sketch. Good morning.
Good morning. The purpose of the briefing is to go ahead and propose basically an agreement with APTA to provide outside expert review services when we hit an issue that is of technical nature, either on the ongoing construction or something that's come up on the operating system. It would involve a fee that would be paid from the capital budget that's anticipated to be in the $50,000 per year range. It also would require an indemnification clause that requires board approval, so that we're getting that advice and not having any kind of a long-term issue with what the ramifications of the advice are. We had a program that was very limited years ago when we had the major capital program. It was really limited to the civil, structural, and tunneling aspects. It was done through our on-call consultant. And what we're looking for is something that's much, much broader than that right now, because we need to have the availability not only of the civil structural type of consulting help, but also things that go in the train control, communications, and really all the aspects of our business. We've had some situations recently where we've had to put together some panels that have helped us with rail cars. They've helped us work through some things when we had a track circuit problem near the Roslyn Tunnel several years ago. So it's something that we've had the ongoing need, and we really need to have the formal structured process to be able to get that availability of staff. There are other locations where this is done. GSA has an ongoing program that is more extensive than what we're proposing. GSA really has something that people are involved in each phase of the project. They would come out at different points during the construction or completion process to give that type of expert help and advice. But this really is based to be on an incident type situation that, as opposed to an ongoing process involved with each project. As I said a couple minutes ago, what we're looking for is not only the civil and tunneling areas, but also the systems area. The traction power, we set up a peer review as part of the traction power upgrade program. But each time that you have to go through and set these up for an individual item or an individual occurrence from ground zero, it takes a time to get it in place. So this would allow for the immediate response by using a series of people that could come from other transit properties, from consulting firms, from the academic world, from industry, so that we've got the availability of the qualified people to go ahead and help us with it, whatever that issue is that came up at that time. APT is the only industry-wide vehicle that we have to be able to go in that direction. It's comprised, as you're all aware, of all the other transit properties around the country. So there isn't any other place to go for the same type of service to get the help and counsel of other transit properties. As I said, that this would be something that would be set up. The reviews would be a quick hit, a limited duration. We don't anticipate any of them to be super high dollars. We've kind of looked at it that there may be a need for 4, 6, 8 per year. It really depends upon what problems come up. There might be one year that you'd have 2 or 3, and the next year you might need a few more than that. So it's really having the vehicle in place and being able to go ahead and get that responsiveness.
Just, Mr. Chairman, I will tell you one which is very close to me now. I'm getting ready to brief you next month on our bus program. And one of the things I would like to do next month is to give you an advice, my recommendation to you, about the new procurement of buses. What new procurement of buses we should, because we have money on the Metro Matters and we need to get on. For that, I ask General Motors chief engineer to give me the General Motors calculations on the hybrid engines. And they gave it to me based on 7 million miles of data collection they have. Then I ask our colleagues in Seattle to do that because they run hybrid and I have it. And I have it. Well, I can come to you and say, you know, here is what General Motors says, here is what Seattle says. I think the hybrid is a good bus. Let's consider go for it. What I would like to do is I would like to use something like that and get 3 people who really are experts on the subject matter to come here for a couple of days and see what I have in front of me and tell me whether I'm on the right track or not, or they have some further advice. It's like I was telling someone yesterday about it. It's really another check and balance system and can happen quickly and efficiently versus going through a lengthy process to procure those In addition, that gives you opportunities if you want to do some reviews and some requests that you have. That's a safety. My colleague Fred Cudin, he does a lot of the safety reviews and so on. He can get advantage of something like that. I think that's a good tool for us to have it.
Let me just say, this is a little bit like we did have to peer reviews on the big single project thing. You're trying to get it, it sounds to me like, for smaller things on an ongoing basis. And you have to do that, you have to pay after $60,000 up front, and then you pay a fee when you do it, which wouldn't exceed $100,000 for any specific project. Are you expecting to have a limit on how much you can spend in a period of time, like in a year on that?
Well, like David said, that we don't plan to do more than 5-6, but every time we do, I will come and report to you. I have a commitment
there. Do you need to have a request for funding on each individual item if you were to do it? Well, I'm asking what you're intended, because, I mean, if it was less than $100,000, then you wouldn't have to, right?
Yes, only if it's above the $100,000.
So, I mean, the one question that naturally arises, no matter what the merits of this are, you know, people would tend to wonder, at least on our side of the table, does that mean they run up 5 or 6 of these, which, you know, if it was one thing, would clearly be a matter that would be a board matter, but it all comes in under the wire, and you wind up spending $500,000 before we know it that we didn't authorize.
We can establish a notification process, which you be notified. We can figure a way which, any way will make you comfortable. I can come and report to you. I can put it in
one of the books. Just a posting question. Can I
offer the flip side of that if we're not careful? Because I have learned that it actually does take an awful lot to get stuff through the board for approval. I mean, months, actually. that we'd have to be real careful that we don't miss an opportunity to have a quick hit and get some good outside advice and make sure we get the right answer. I think at the end of the day, this is a tool that would help us get the best product, which at the end of the day, I think, is what the board is looking for. I would ask that maybe we put together a work plan going forward that then the board could review, and that we give you updating and notification of what we're doing or when we do it. But I'd be sensitive to the idea that we push it through, you know, the MEED process and make it a very difficult thing.
I didn't offer a specific suggestion about how you would do anything. I'm simply pointing out a potential issue. I mean, there are other approaches, such as, you know, you come to us for a specific amount that's a ceiling in which you can use a period of time. But I'm just throwing the issue out there. Mr. Smith.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a little question. First of all, my first question, you know what the question is. What kind of dues do we pay to F?
$53,451.
Okay, we say $53,000. I asked them earlier to get that number. So $53,000 a year in dues to APT. Now this says a one-time. Am I reading that one-time APT administrative charge of approximately $62,000?
Up to.
Up to. It doesn't say up to, Dan. It says...
Oh, I see on page 8 it says up to.
I'm on 7. Okay, on 8.
8 looks...
On 8 it's up to, on 7 it's not. Okay. Funding for the capital...
On 8 means funding up to. I think Mr. Smith's correct. It seems to indicate that the APTA fee is $62,500. Is there any question about that?
The anticipated fee for a 15-month period, the estimate right now is $62,500.
Well, for a 15-month period?
For a 15-month period.
In other words, there's a base charge.
Okay, so it's one time for the 15 months.
One time is probably not a good way to describe
it. Right, I agree. Yeah, that made it sound like it was a deal, right? Yeah, like we're going to have a lifetime fee there. Okay. All right, so one time charge of $62,500 that covers 15 months. So after that, annually, it's roughly $50,000 is what you were saying.
Plus whatever we use, yes.
Okay, and so we'd be paying $50,000 to APTA. And could you elaborate a little more? What service would they provide to us for $50,000 a year?
I was trying to use the example of the hybrid. And let's say we have this authorization. I'm going to have Bob Golden, who's our project manager for buses, call that person in APTA and say, we would like to have a peer review in the next couple of weeks with 3-4 people who know hybrid, and he will tell them the qualifications we're looking. Then APTA is going to get through their contacts and get us 3, 4, 5 people who know about hybrids. And we're going to tell them, make sure 2 are coming from bus operators, like Seattle. 1 comes from the industry, from Detroit, whomever, GM, whomever does the hybrid engines or Allison or what else. And they're going to put them together. They're going to organize them. They're going to set up the meeting for us. Sometimes we do it here. Sometimes we do it in Aptas offices. Pay the people, arrange for the travel expenses, and then give us one bill. We pay it based on the auditor's general audit default rate. That's it.
Okay, so effectively, we're going to pay a $50,000 a year retainer.
Yes,
to Apta,
yes.
To be a broker of expertise for us. While concurrently, we do pay $53,000 a year in dues to the association, the organization. Yeah, it just seems to me, I don't know, I'm a member of the American Institute of Architects. I pay dues every year of, I guess our firm pays about $1,500 worth of dues. And we don't then pay a retainer to the AIA to draw out expertise from the AIA. If we have an issue that we are dealing with legislatively in a state in the country, or technically in terms of the latest industry practices for expertise on green buildings, on structural failures, things like that, we can call in to the AIA and get that expertise that the AIA has mounted out of there, or they would gladly direct us to those persons in the country that would have that information.
A couple of answers to that.
Why do we pay a $50,000 retainer fee to have to do that for us?
This is a new process that we're going to be setting up with APTA for a service that goes beyond calling other transit properties. In the discussions that we've had with APTA, there's probably going to be interest at other transit properties to be able to use this same new service from APTA at other properties around the country, where you would bring in more than just the typical industry, typical individuals off of other transit properties. And it's that reaching out to the academic world and to consultants and other industry places that is currently not set up for APTA to do. So it's a new service that they're going to provide that they're interested in trying to use not only for us, but also across the country.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because, like again, in the AIA parallel example, there's a whole movement to do studies in neuroscience and how design, how quality design and levels of quality design can affect one's mind and mindset in an office environment, in a work environment. And that's all being, you know, like we're doing that. The AIA is funding neuro research at Salk Institute out in San Diego, and that research is available to all the members of the AIA, as expertise. I mean, they've gone. It's not people in the AIA building talking to other architects. They've gone out and are doing research.
Are you going to tell me that you're confident that the AIA doesn't have add-on services that for extra fee you could buy? If I called them there right now, I would find out that in fact they do.
Well, sure, we have a bookstore, we have a contracts management, things like that that you could do for a fee. I'm having a hard time relating to, first of all, what we get out of APTA. I know that a lot of us are signed up to go over to APTA's legislative conference next week, and no one asked if we wanted to go or not.
Hardly relevant.
Well, I am concerned about what we're doing with APTA and APTA creating new marketing tools to raise funds for itself by creating new services. What other transit agencies in the country do this?
Oh, New York does extensively.
They pay APTA a fee regularly. Sure. What kind of fee does New York pay APTA?
I don't know. What I'm telling you, Mr. Smith, about $50,000 a year, you have somebody in APTA who can pick up the phone and say, get me a hybrid engineering review in the next 2 weeks and get attention and get that person to work and make phone calls and give you a list, the recommended resumes and so on. I think it's a very good and economical service. I can take you through and show you what it would have taken to do it ourselves, because I just finished 3 expert reviews on the rail cars, as you know, and it's really very painful. Takes a lot of people, a lot of processing. The contracting officer has to go through, the auditor general has to go through, the general counsel has to go through. I have to bring it to you. It's a lot of these things which takes a lot of time. Sometimes we say, don't do that. And it's not a good idea. to not do that. And it's like Mr. Angelolini said, it's a very good idea to get a pair of eyes from the outside coming in and spend a couple of days here. I thought exactly the same way you're articulating. Why do I pay those guys $50,000, $60,000 a year to help me administer this program? And we went through. This is not a new idea. We've been working 6 months on this thing. And it's us, the procurement office, and the lawyers. And it's pretty good economical thing to do it. So that's where I am.
Another example, specifically from New York, there is a program that MIT runs. It's called the Industrial Program, that they provide help to other transit properties. They have a relationship with Chicago. They have a relationship with New York City. And there's a $25,000 per year annual fee to become part of that program, to be able to get that outside expertise from the academic side. That is the kind of academic outreach that we would be able to get in a different vein by using APTA as the vehicle to get to those same types of resources.
Well, I think before we go to the board, if we could get a synopsis of what other transit properties in this country pay a fee to APTA and utilize this type of service, and maybe just a rough scenario of what kind of projects they've done with them, I would appreciate that.
Well, nothing's been approved yet. We don't even have a motion, so you know, let's not assume where we're going with this. In any case, there are separate issues here. One has to do with whether this is the service we think we need. The other is what we think we're going to pay for it. And you can think one's a good idea and not be ready to sign off on the other. Our budget, now our chairman.
But I'm going to ask a budget question.
But, right. Most budget-minded person perhaps among us, Mrs. Mack.
Exactly. We'll sort out the merits of the program, and it does seem to have some value. I guess the question that I would ask is, if you believe that you will require about 5 of these reviews a year, and your estimate is that they cost $100,000 each, that would pay for expenses for the experts who come here, and what else? That's a lot.
And our colleagues from the transit industry, we are not going to pay for them. But if it's an engineer from General Motors, we might have to pay 1 day or 2 days of his salary.
So what has been the experience with has APTA done this for any other transit authority besides New York?
Yes. I'm pretty sure they have done it for BART. I know BART and LA do a lot of these things. But I get you the answers to all these questions.
And my comment is that if we're talking $500,000, that's a budget item. And it has to be included in our budget consideration.
Yeah.
It's the idea is to actually use funds associated with the particular capital project that we're having an issue with. So the idea would be up to $100,000 if there was, and again, it's up to, if there was an issue, a considerable issue with a considerable capital project, and we wanted to get some outside expertise, rather than just letting it continue to chunk along or then sending up a red flag and coming back through the whole board process to get the process going, procure such expertise as the project continues to have problems. This is the ability to pick up the phone and say, get us 3 experts so we can get out of this problem.
But wait a minute. And I want to get a clarification on that because I thought service was going to answer that.
Okay.
You said that the funds would be associated with a particular project. You'd be paying for it out of a project that you're working on.
It's out of the project.
In which case, I have a hard time understanding why we're having this conversation, because if you're doing it in a particular project budget and it's going to cost $80,000 or whatever it's going to cost, if it's going to cost some above a threshold, then you have to come back and get the okay, which we were going to make you do anyway. Or if it's below the threshold, you'd be doing it anyway, you wouldn't ask us. So
the flip side is, how much flexibility do you have in the budget of the project? I mean, it gets, you got $100,000, maybe you have $200,000,
The issue is to get the vehicle set up at the front end, so that when we do have the problem, nobody can sit here right now and know which one of the couple hundred projects that we've got going on is going to have a problem.
Okay, but we have two issues. We have the action itself, and then we have how it's got to be funded. And I think on the action itself, it certainly does seem to have some merit. We've got to continue to look at, the action looks like it's something we ought to do. Question is, how is it going to be funded? And that's the part that we're want to focus on right now. If the cost of this is in the project budget, the question is, Where is it in the project budget? How much flexibility exists in a project budget? If you came up with another good idea that, you know, you needed to fund, would you also be able to find that in the project budget?
I mean, I think the issue there is these are projects that we feel are actually have some result, have some potential for failing, and failing projects tend to cost more. The real issue is try to avoid coming back to the board and saying, we need more money in this project because it didn't go the way we wanted it to go. This is an attempt, really, to have a mechanism as we go through a project to make sure we're making the right decisions if we see a red flag come up. So, you know, there are professional services budgets within the projects. We would then say, okay, instead of sending it to Consultant X as part of the original project plan, we're going to bring in a couple people to make sure we're going in the right direction. Anytime we would exceed the project budget or even heading towards exceeding the project budget, clearly we'd have to come back to the board. This is really an attempt to actually get a better handle on these projects, get outside eyes on the projects, and turn to the broader world and ask the question, are we doing it right? Can we do it better?
Then I agree with Mr. Zerman. If the capacity exists within the project, and it's going to be on a kind of as-needed basis...
Just do it.
Yeah, I mean, we don't need to
approve that. Mrs. Mike, we wanted you to know we're setting up this tool. We're going to execute an agreement, and we cannot execute an agreement on your behalf without you authorize us to do it. And the $62,000 is not really the issue of authority because, as you said, it's within the projects, but it's, we're getting to an agreement with an entity which has to be only you to approve it. That's the thing. It's not really the economics of it, if you like it. It's the authority to enter with APTA to an agreement which we can do the service. And I wanted you to know about it. It's me.
I'm glad. Thank you. I'm pleased with the transparency.
I wanted you to know about it.
Well, I think, personally, I don't have a problem. The only thing that jumps out to me, has jumped out to others, is just an upfront amount since we're already paying something. But the idea of having the on-call expertise is great. Given all the time we spent on issues of, you know, we continue to spend on precision stopping or going back to the switches when we had that problem. I mean, presenting it in terms of the time we could have saved and the quality service we could have continued.
The switch relays.
And, you know, recently on an operations side with the paratransit challenge that Mrs. Mack has presented me, we were looking at trying to pull some folks together quickly from APTA, and they couldn't do it quickly because there isn't kind of the standing grab pull. So being able to, rather than letting problems fester, I think Mr. Tangrilini well phrased it, if we can beat APTA down a little bit on that upfront fee, fine, because they need us.
I apologize for not focusing in on that issue, and I appreciate the board doing it. I've been trading calls with the executive director of APTA to talk to him. And I have a new line number one subject matter to discuss with them. What is the additional value we're going to get for this contribution above the substantial money we're already spending on the organization?
That's the only
one. I think that's not an unfair question.
Yeah. All right. Mr. Solomon.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a good idea. Just maybe some additional information would have been helpful to get around some of these questions. For instance, when I first read the presentation, it sounded like this program has been around for years, but it sounded like you're creating this program now with APTA, which is a good idea. So my question is, how long has it been in existence? Has other transit agencies used it, like Mr. Smith said? And if it's been in existence before, why haven't we heard about it? Because, I mean, we've been here for a long time, and we've taken advantage of this before. And then the budgetary issues have to be resolved, because if it's in a particular department, we just use the money out of that department's budget as opposed.
We never had an agreement like this with APTA before. What David was saying is back in the old days when we had heavy tunneling and construction of our subway system, we had the board of expert consultants. I think the board had approved those consultants, very famous geotechnical engineers, to be standby. And every time we would have a problem, Mrs. Mack, maybe you remember, they will come and review the issues with the soils and other stuff. That is what we had. And just recently, I was, through our consulting engineers, get 2-3 expert reviews going on for some of the problems I had on the rail cars. For that, no, we never had a systematized way like this, like what Mr. Smith said. have up down retaining and go ahead and call for expert services as we need. No, we never did that.
The other good part about using APTA is it gives it the independence. You're not bringing the expertise in through one of the other consultants that we already have. And you've got the mix of being able to get the outside people from the academic world, independent consultants, and also other transit properties. And it's those outside consultants and the independents that have not been part of the previous APTA peer reviews. It's basically been individuals from other transit properties. That's the big change.
Yeah, on a small, I want to jump to another point in this, and that's the indemnification clause. And I think we're going to need general counsel to help us on this, because the documents that we've been involved in over the last 6 months or so, I'm now light up when I see the term willful in anything. And we've got willful misconduct in here. Can you tell us on the art of the difference between willful misconduct and misconduct and what that would mean in terms of indemnification?
Well, normally indemnification protects the indemnity against the negligence of the other party. And negligence is usually considered an unintentional act. When you're talking about willful, it's a higher standard of proof in the sense that usually it's negligence that is so flagrant that borders on.
But the clause says that the these experts that would be giving us their opinion on which we'd make decisions arising out of the provision of this review, except to the extent that such claims arise or are caused by negligence or willful misconduct of APTA.
Right.
So if APTA is negligent, we have right to a claim. If APTA is willfully misconducting its affairs in some way versus just misconducting its affairs in some way, we have a right to a claim. And the difference between the willful misconduct and just APTA screwing up is we don't have a claim.
That's so flagrant that it merges on
an intention. And a desire to maim in some way.
I think the reason they're asking for this type of indemnification is that the expanded peer review concept that we have here, we get not only the active peer concept, but professionals aren't going to be signing stealing things. They're going to be giving a second set of eyes and oversight. Normally, when we engage those types of services, they identify us. In this instance, we're saying, come in, and you don't have to sign and seal, but and we'll hold you harmless from any exceptional service conduct.
Is this basically about the nature of the advice that they? Is this about, in other words, we have to bring somebody in. It's really the somebody. They give some advice as a result of this. Is that the main area of exposure you're protecting them from?
Well, we're protecting APTA because they, again, they're using the language that they require when we go to them, which is the pure peer review. They're going to bring people in, they're acting on our behalf.
Yeah, what's the reason? What is it they're being protected against? I mean, obviously, if somebody came in here and did something, you know, stole something, you know, they're not going to be protected from that. You know, if they engaged in something that was, intended to advantage some contractor or something like that. I mean, something like that that's obviously misconduct. You know, they wouldn't be protected from, they'd be held responsible for that, clearly. Yes? Okay. Suppose we do one of these things. They bring somebody in who's coming to our property, doing an analysis, giving advice. In the course of that, suppose such a person did something intended to advantage some contractor.
Yeah, then they would be liable.
They would be guilty of that, and there's none of this would protect them from whatever sanctions are involved. Is the thing that the reason somebody needs this clause, I mean, why do they want this? Is it because, having given advice in good faith, their best opinion, their best expert opinion. Someone obviously can quarrel with the result of this.
Correct.
Metro puts in a new practice. Somebody subsequently decides to sue you.
Correct.
And they cite everybody involved who's involved in the policy that led to what it is they're suing over. The person who comes in from the outside doesn't want to be held responsible because we took their advice that was given in good faith based on their best expertise and understanding.
That's
what you're protecting them against.
That's what we try.
Did that help it?
Someone.
Okay. If I can follow that, though, is there? I sensed in your first answer a distinction between willful and intentional. Is there a legal distinction?
Willful, again. There's negligence, there's misconduct, there's a lot of negligence types of things that occur.
Negligence is trying to, it's just you screwed up.
Normally people don't intend them. Sometimes, however, people are so unmindful of the duty of care that their conduct rises to willful, which equates with intentional. That's a high
standard. As opposed to I set out to commit a crime and plotted it, you can be careless enough that it could be viewed as, in effect, an intentional act.
Yes. And that is, of course, much worse than mere intent.
Thank you for the legal lesson for today. Smith, any further questions?
No.
It seems to me that this is basically a good idea, that we would like our folks asking for opinions on the outside of experts and figuring out, which is really what this is about, you know, if they're doing things the right way. It's the kind of thing we usually push them to do, and they're asking to be authorized to do it.
I wish Fairfax
so
County.
Somehow that makes sense. But the biggest question really is...
the suit came out.
The question is, in this circumstance, you only have one buyer. I mean, if you go out and say, we're going to put an RFP for this kind of thing, that would be more normal. There's one institution to do this, which happens to be an association of which we're a part. And, you know, there's clearly at least one member who doesn't like the idea of saying up front how much we're going to pay them, you know, to play in this thing. And I kind of sympathize with that. I don't know exactly what a fair contract is, but I don't like the idea that we're putting the number out there in our action and they already know how much they're getting. Clearly there are services we get, that's why we're dues-paying members. And there can be services on top of that, and it's not unreasonable to pay extra for it. Still, there can be a blurry line somehow between what are the actual... I used to work for one of these organizations, so I understand how members feel about that kind of thing. You know, what is it I'm already paying for versus what it is you want to sell me now? And I don't know that we should go in there saying we're going to pay this much when there's some question of definition here. So my own view is we should give some authority to go ahead and get this ball rolling. But we shouldn't commit to paying a certain amount or some basis up front. And that at the time we have something negotiated there, we should be able to see and clearly, you know, answer questions such as Mr. Smith asked, okay, what's the difference between what we're already entitled to because we already paid them and something new that's being provided? So I don't know how to affect that, but that would be my suggestion.
Agreed. Well,
I agree with that.
Agreed.
So let's see. So what would the action be? Help me out.
The action, from what I understood you, is that you think this is a good idea, get on to it, negotiate an agreement with APTA, but you are not comfortable on the 62 or the 50,000 per year.
I think what I'm saying is I'd like to see you authorized to begin such a negotiation and return with a contract. I think I just moved that.
Second.
Recommendation be forward to the board. And I assume that if there's a budget item, of course, there's a budget committee involved.
Okay, who's going to come to that?
Budget committee will probably want to see that, too. Okay, so everybody understand what the motion is?
Yep.
Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion carried. Okay.
The next item, Mr. Chairman, is Edward Thomas and Scott Kubley will take you through. We are ready to submit our 07-2030 constrained long-range plan.
Okay, what happened to the Glenmont? I mean, I'm happy to do CLRP next, which is, we probably
okay.
Have folks wanting
then
to know when
I'm
we
sorry,
get
I jumped ahead of you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the question.
Second.
Okay, that's on the Glenmont, not on the CLRP, but on the Glenmont, right? Okay, so just to clarify, so everybody can find the recommendation so they know what it is that Mr. Smith moved. It was that the board authorized the holding of a public hearing and the revised general plans and environmental evaluation of the proposed Dunmar parking structure, and authorize the general manager to release the public hearing staff report, including staff recommendations for public comment as soon as the report is available.
Is that your motion, Mr. Smith?
I thought that's what
it was. Sure was what I seconded.
Is there any discussion on this? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion carries. Easy bit of work there. now to the not-so-easy event. We spent a fair amount of time talking about a $62,000 item. There's a little more money involved in this next item. Little bit. Mr. Thomas?
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Those members of the Planning and Development Committee. You know, periodically, the Transportation Planning Board updates its long-range plan, and that's happening now. They have put out a call to the transit agencies and the highway agencies in the region and the states to provide input, and that's what we're here to talk to you about today. Particularly, our purpose today is to brief you on the recommendations we'd like to put forward vis-a-vis WMATA's inputs to the CLRP and to ask the committee to endorse the recommendations through a resolution and forward that resolution to the board for approval. Just to give you a little bit of background on the importance of the this 25-year CLRP, it really is tied to the federal transportation planning requirements. There's an appendix in this package for your review. Pretty much lays out the requirements for the long-range planning and as well the development of the six-year transportation improvement program. Those two documents do, in fact, go to the Federal Highway Administration and the Federal Transit Administration for their review and approval. In order for these projects that we would put forward into these plans and programs to be approved, they would have to be part of the CLRP and the TIP. The other key point here is that in order for projects like the Dulles Project or Columbia Pike New Starts to be approved by the federal government, they too must be part of the CLRP, even to get into the process of being developed. Further into the engineering aspect of the project. So those are some of the highlights of why it's important that we have the CLRP. There is another attachment on the New Starts planning and development process in terms of how the decisions get made for the project flows from the long-range plan, system-wide planning, into the corridor planning and development activities and further into the engineering and finally to get to full funding. Agreement. We've had a lot of experience with that process. The next slide just provides some background to kind of where we've come from as we provided input to the CLRP in the past 6 or 7 years. In 2000, WMATA worked with the Transportation Planning Board to actually constrain the travel demand in the core up to 2005 because we really didn't have the fleet to match the crowding that we expected to have at that particular point in time. We ultimately got approval from the board to go forward with the 6,000 series cars, the 62 that Dan and his group talked about a little bit earlier. And those vehicles are obviously starting to be delivered and will provide some relief around 2008. The Metro Matters program has an additional 122 rail cars in there, which will give us about 38% eight-car train operation system-wide and reduce some of the crowding in the system around about 86% of the capacity that we would make available with the new cars.
Mr. Thomas, I thought it was going up to 50%. The 33% was the number we used initially, but at this point we determined it's higher.
December 2.5% above.
Is that not associated with Metro Matters?
Metro Matters investment, yes.
All right, thank you.
Okay. All right, the 10-year plan and the Blue Ribbon Panel report on dedicated funding assumed that we would also get an additional 130 rail cars, which would be the balance of the 10-year plan that we put forth in October 2002. That, too, would increase the percentage of eight-car train operations. I should point out that the 122 rail cars would be funded out of the assumption in Metro Matters was that $260 million would be made available out of the federal discretionary program. That last bullet there indicates that Safety Lou provided $104 million, and there's still a difference of $154 million in funding that we're pursuing through the federal discretionary funding program. Going back to the slide, to the bullet on the Dulles extension, with the Dulles extension, we assumed in the financial plan that we would be operating 100% ACAR trains system-wide. That would require another 90 vehicles, the Dulles vehicles, plus additional 28 or 29 cars. Now, the Federal Transit Administration did raise an issue about some inconsistencies between the first bullet on this slide, where we constrained the ridership in the core, and the assumption that we would be operating 100% ACAR trains as a result of the Dulles extension. This submittal that we're going to recommend to you really addresses that particular inconsistency. If we can go to the next slide. I'm going to run you through quickly the assumptions on the capital side and the operating side. To the degree that you want to get more into the details of the cash flows that we have here, Scott will kind of take you into the details. But obviously, one of the assumptions on the cost side is the Metro Atlantic Agreement, $3.3 billion of investments there. I mentioned the 10-year plan balance plus the Blue Ribbon Panel report is assumed in there as well. What you would get, about 130 additional rail cars, 275 buses, maybe one or two additional bus garages, and some other improvements in the stations and connections and so forth. On the infrastructure renewal side, this is a new number that you have not seen, $507 million on average per year. It's a bit higher than what we have in the Metro Matters at 438, because we've added another 13 miles to the system since we developed that $438 million average. And we have some new stations, three new stations on the system. So those additional assets account for the difference between the 438 number in Metro Matters and the 407. We have a better estimate. I did note that we are assuming some additional rail cars and any support facilities associated with those. On the revenue side, the Metro Matters funding, we're assuming some modest growth in the federal funding beyond 2011, about 2.75% growth in the federal, mostly the federal formula funds, both for the modernization category and as well as the ongoing capital maintenance. Additional growth is assumed in local and state share. On the capital side, you see the number there. That is an increase over what you've seen before. We're not assuming any dedicated funding associated with the Davis build or local and state resources. In addition, I should point out that we haven't assumed any internally generated funds from parking, joint development, advertising, and interest. There are some numbers on the non-passenger side as part of Metro Matters, and those revenues are included, but we didn't include any beyond what's in the Metro Matters agreement. So if you want to go through some of the detail in terms of what we're proposing to submit to TPB, Scott can kind of take you through that.
Right there, let's see. First question is on line 7 from the first 4-year period. I don't know how that broken up, but we've got a jump in federal formula funds on line 7. Pretty significant one. What's the source of that?
Well, we're going to definitely be operating more mileage as part of the Dulles project and other improvements that we'll be making in the system. So as the mileage increases, your share of the federal funds would grow.
Okay. There's no way that Dulles accounts for that much of a
chunk. No, definitely not.
And I don't know of any other extensions that would add. What else is there that would land in that?
If we're providing more bus miles, we've got 185.
So you have some number of assumed increase in bus.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the assumed assumption. It's the assumption of the increase in federal funding.
So you think you're going to get $450 million more, you know, an increase of more than 50%, it looks like, from just extending the rail line 23 miles and from growth in bus service?
Plus 2.75% per year in that program.
Just because of...
Well, we've made an assumption. We've made an assumption that's pretty consistent with what occurred with the safety loop. That 2.75 is really a rate of growth that occurred between teacher
and regular growth, they say.
Yeah.
Now, I'm trying to think which is the right table here. There's a table here that shows, one of these shows federal funds in the appendix. I guess the question is, this, first off, on the expenditure side, the program that's in here assumes not only Metro Matters, but what was in the Blue Ribbon Panel recommendations, essentially the applied program there, for which we're short funding $3 billion, is assumed in this.
Is assumed.
Right. Okay. And the Dulles extension is assumed.
It's also assumed.
Yes, on the operating side. On the operating side.
It's assumed we're going to build Dulles and do it.
Yes. But the capital costs of Dulles are not included in this table. That's
part of Virginia cost. I understand. Okay. But all costs associated with WMATA are assumed in.
Yes, sir.
And that's identified on slide 8, which is the operating.
Okay. Is there anything else? Any other big chunks? Does that cover the, you know, growth in the existing system, obviously?
The only thing that is not in a board-approved document is the 90 additional rail cars required to get up to 100% eight-car trains. The reason that is in there is that's part of the long-term operating plan, but it falls outside the envelope of any capital program that has been presented to the board. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've got a relatively maximal plan on the expenditure side. On the revenue side, what is assumed, apart from the formula money we were just talking about, it appears that the discretionary line, we got blanks on. The 260 comes out of the recently approved transportation bill?
$104 million.
Okay. And the rest of that 260?
We would continue to pursue the balance.
Okay, so you don't actually have any of that either. And you're assuming nothing from 2011 to 2030?
Correct. That's correct.
So there's no, for instance, no Davis bill?
Correct.
No increased federal participation in this at all?
Correct.
Okay, so the working assumption is that we're going to actually do the program that's talked about as a new partnership between federal, state, and local governments, but we're not assuming the funding from our federal partners.
Well, this submission that we're sending over...
New phone?
This submission that we're sending over to COG is our request, our need. Now, as the CLRP gets developed, each jurisdiction will make an input as to what their ability to pay is. And so
the answer to my question was yes.
Yes.
Right. So the implication of that, if we're assuming the expenditure but not the revenue, mm-hmm. is that money's got to come from somewhere.
Yes.
So what are we telling, I mean, if you're submitting this to COG, not to COG actually, to TPB, which I always like to make the distinction that they aren't COG, they're really housed there, but the MPO for our region, which has the responsibility under federal law for establishing this, what is it you're giving them as, I mean, constrained, the C in the CLRP means constrained. It's constrained by the funding that under some federal definition is reasonably expected to be available.
That's the key.
So you're telling me that your view is you can't claim that that federal money is reasonably expected to be available.
We are saying that we expect the federal programs to grow. And that funding is reasonably expected to be available.
The money that you're not putting in here, the additional federal funding for the program that we have on the expenditure side that we've all talked about in terms of such a partnership,
right.
You're not claiming that money. I mean, why not put it in? Why not put the Davis bill money in?
Exactly. Well, we could, and obviously it would have to be matched, and we've assumed that the local share, the state share would go up. We just don't identify.
You've assumed that.
Well, I'm sorry. It seems to me you're not, I mean, it's one thing to assume the local and state share of that program if you're also assuming the federal half of it. But if you're not assuming the federal half of it, then aren't you assuming something? Someone's going to fill in the blank for local share.
Yeah. And what we did in that particular instance was that we didn't want to make any assumptions about dedicated funding. And assuming that the Davis bill was, in fact, put forth for the purposes thereof, and since the issues haven't been settled at the local and state level, we weren't sure exactly, quite frankly, how we wanted to handle that.
I understand that dilemma. And my point is that I'm not sure whether we're ready then to handle the expenditure side either. Now, so
someone has done the arithmetic for me, and their calculation is that the local share, if you go ahead with this and you don't have the federal funds, and you assume implicitly that the member jurisdictions are picking up the tab, that in year 5, 2011, the local share would jump from 2010 to 2011, would jump from 226 million to 450 million. In other words, it would double, because we're picking up the entire federal share, presumably, then. I submit that those funds cannot reasonably be expected to be available.
This is very similar to what we did in the 2003 CLRP. We sent a submission over to TPB, and the local funding jurisdictions put in their submission of what revenue could be reasonably expected, and that there was around a 5% shortfall that was unfunded, and that was noted in the CLRP. So we're pursuing a similar track this year. That's what we would propose to pursue, is to send over what we project our need to be, allow the locals to submit what they assume their revenues will be, and then any shortfall would have to be addressed at that point.
That's not necessarily unreasonable. I mean, our job here is basically to supply the service. It's one thing to say, here's what we'll need for the service that you're expecting. But then I think we have to specifically call out the funding gap, because it's TPB's job to put together something that's defensible on the basis of funds reasonably expected to be available. And the region needs to understand that this project, this program, cannot be done unless additional funding is provided.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Kaufman?
I think more than anything, whether it's intended or not, I think more than anything, this puts in black and white what failure of this additional, our attempts to get this additional funding mean long-term to this region. This is triple-digit millions on an ongoing basis if we don't succeed.
Yes, it is. That's exactly right. What we're asked for here is to forward these as inputs to the full board for approval and authorization for the general manager to forward the inputs to TPB. As I said, I think it's okay to do that, because I think it's a good summary of, you know, what we think needs to be done over the period of time, the one half of it. But I think that whatever form we send it over, it should be explicit about the funding requirements and explicitly call out the dollar amounts not identified. Because, I mean, some of these, you know, making assumptions about, you know, federal formula funds that we don't actually know, but you can make a reasonable estimate and you can justify on the basis of what's happened before. But for something that requires entirely new funding sources that aren't available, we need to make clear that that's what's involved. We can do this program if you do this. But if you don't, then we can't, and it won't be the long-range plan.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Mack.
I agree with you. I also think that as we send this to TPB, we need to send it to the local jurisdictions, because they need to know what we're sending. And I think they need to have that same type of explanation of the meaning of these numbers.
Exactly right, Ms. Mack. I wouldn't limit that to local.
Because,
of course, in your case, Logan State happens to be the same place. But
right.
We've got some other folks who probably need to understand that also, and right now would be a good time for them to understand it.
We have. In fact, there have been some conversations, but Scott can tell you more specifically.
We meet on a monthly basis at a staff level.
Yes, we understand that. It's not staff. We have to explain things to them.
Right. And
so
we
perhaps a bit more formal.
This doesn't need to be a formal transmittal to the decision makers, the policy makers.
So
chart that has the zero line, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
You have a chart that has Davisville and zero.
Yeah.
You need to add that.
No,
yeah,
and that's
agree.
what I'd ask then is that when this comes forward to the board, it be, you know, put together in a form that makes very clear the issue we're talking about, which really is the fundamental issue of the strength and range plan for the next 25 years, and that it lays out exactly the funding gap that is identified here.
And then
then forward it not only to TPB but to relevant other policymakers who want to know.
And it certainly makes the point on the operating expenses. I mean, this is really scary if you look at the levels that will be required here.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. So
we need people to be looking at that. Understand?
Yep.
That that's the decision they're making.
Absolutely.
Is that a motion?
That's a motion.
Second.
Is the motion understood?
Yep.
Dangling.
Yeah.
Okay. There wasn't any ambiguity.
All right. I don't think there was any.
Is there any further discussion?
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Sir.
Mr. Chairman,
we
have
less time dispensing with $3 billion than it took us to talk about $62,000.
I noted that, by the way.
The usual pattern in government, as I found.
We have one more item. Gary Malasky will take you through here. Is the GSA asked us to consider working with them in an agreement to build canopies connecting the new Census Bureau building with our Suitland station, and they're going to follow the design and the material we use for our canopies. Mr. Malasky is here to take you through this week.
Succinctly, Mr. Malasky, please.
Okay, I'd be happy to do that. Again, it's your approval for us to enter into a connection agreement. I'll just go through and summarize these slides. This is something that GSA asked for. They are going to pay for it. They are going to maintain it. There currently is a canopy from the station to the garage. It will then be extended to the census headquarters. We have negotiated with them that if the garage is expanded, we have the right to move the canopy at our expense. So we're asking you to give us authorization to complete negotiations on the agreement and to enter into the connection agreement.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sullivan.
I will move the item.
Second.
Motion is made to approve the recommendation. Second by Mr. Coffin. Discussion, Mr. Smith.
I have a question on page 5. Why the convoluted hoops here of GSA owns and maintains the canopy. We own and maintain the sidewalk. Although the sidewalk is going to be upgraded by GSA, so we're going to have to own and maintain it to some upgraded standard that GSA is providing. Why all that?
We didn't want to assume the cost of maintaining the canopy. So we asked for them to give us an annual amount to cover the maintenance amount, and they absolutely refused to do it. And so it really is a cost issue. This is the only structure where we're able to get them to agree to maintain the annual operating cost.
So they maintain the canopy.
Yes.
We take care of the sidewalk underneath it.
Which we have to do anyway. It's an existing sidewalk.
But it's upgraded to some standard they have. What's the?
Upgraded. I don't know if I have the details.
Which we upgraded at GSA expense.
It's wider. Wider.
Well, it's wider. Okay. So it's just the sidewalk.
It's
wider.
Just the
sidewalk.
Okay. Right.
All right. And fine arts get involved in this?
There's an existing canopy, and we're just doing it the same design as the existing canopy that currently connects the station to the garage. So we'll continue the same design to the Census Bureau headquarters.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Coffin. Yeah.
Maybe the great mystery question would be is why does the federal government need a wider sidewalk?
Certainly they want to carry more people. I'm guessing the answer is they want to carry more people. That's why the connection and the... No one's speculating on that
people
side.
Than we would design.
They want it wider, they're going to pay for it. We're not asking questions. Is that
I think that pretty much sums it up. Yeah.
Well, and wider is better.
On the maintenance of the canopy, they wouldn't pay us to maintain it. No. So we're making it their responsibility by leaving them with title to the thing.
They would also then remove it if they have the responsibility to remove it at the end of the agreement if it's not extended.
I understand that. Is there any issue about what if they just simply don't maintain it? There are maintenance issues. What are we going to be stuck now with?
It is the federal government. It's certainly in their interest to do it. It seems to me our recourse would be to just block the path if they don't maintain it, if they don't...
We have some leverage here, you're saying.
Okay. You know,
this is our sidewalk.
I'm not going to approve this discussion anybody for
right,
blocking.
There's...
Stop now, Mrs. Mack.
Is this part of our new canopy design?
They ask them for our standard. Right. Are they going to follow our standard?
It's an existing one. Would you like to
have
copies we can hand out? Heidi, do you want
to
pass around? We'll give it to you. It's the existing one,
yeah.
And we have copies.
What's the length of it again?
How long a thing are we talking about?
Right. I know the design. Heidi, do you know the tall length? It's several hundred feet. So it actually goes around the perimeter of the garage. And
so this picture, what am I looking at here? What's this picture of?
This is the existing canopy from the station to the garage.
Okay, so there's going to be more of this?
It will be more of this, exactly right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. It's their money, right?
It's their money.
It's their money.
Right.
I should note that the county's been formed and it's been in discussion. Yes, sir. GSA plans to add an additional 1,000 employees out at that facility.
Ah, hence the need for the wider sidewalk. Yes,
and they're all fat.
Nobody write that down. Nobody write that down. Strike that from the record.
Never mind.
All right. We want more riders. We want more people taking transit to work. And we'd like them to be covered. We believe in canopies. And somebody else, the federal government, is actually being our partner in paying for this one.
Keep our feds dry.
Good thing.
Seems like a good time to vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion carries. Thank you very much.
Two more items, Mr. Chairman.
A couple more information items.
Yes. We do have our semi-annual update of our capital program. Mr. Couch, Mr. Lacoste, and Mr. Burnfield will take you through quickly to show you where your money is invested, like we've been doing twice a year.
It's a very handsome picture you have there on the cover there, Mr. Lacoste, if I may say so.
Yes.
We're going to see if we can land this one.
Okay. I remember a couple of things this night.
Sunday morning, Crystal City. Yep.
Is that an incendiary device?
That had a Virginia State trooper on board because of the fly space that we were in, with specific orders because of the fly zone and being close to National Airport and the monuments and everything else, the Pentagon. That was not an easy lift to pull off. It took a lot of coordination. The overview of where we are right now on page 3 shows the proportionate amounts for each portion of the program this year. The bigger focus this year is on the system side. That absorbs 29% of the program. Lesser amounts for the escalators and also for passenger and maintenance facilities. On page 5, we go through the electrical items that we're in the process of replacing. The upper right picture shows replacement of battery systems. We started out with some square cell batteries similar to what you'd see of the type and different size, obviously, than what's in your car. They're now round, clear batteries with a 40-year life. Lower right is a picture of a UPS system that's been upgraded that provides a backup power so that we don't have interruption of our emergency circuits. On page 6, this shows some of the behind-the-wall motor control centers that control the fans and other devices to provide ventilation systems and also to trigger pump stations and fan shafts that we're in the process of replacing. On page number 7, this is where we've got our traction power work. The first step when you go into a traction power room is to go ahead and put down what's called an amazite pad. It's an isolation pad, and that's what you see in the foreground in this picture. It's preparation work for the addition of the equipment that's being installed to upgrade the traction power system to support 8-car train operations. On page number 8, we're going through and have just completed replacement of sacrificial anodes for cathodic protection. This shows in the top picture an anode being lowered into place in the hole that was augered. It's then connected back to the metallic structure that it's protecting. On page number 9, this is an RTU cabinet where we go ahead and control all the signals and devices from the main data transmission system out and through into the devices and the stations, and this is where we're replacing some of those. Page 10 takes you through some of the train control projects. We've got different modules that we're replacing. In this case, there's some bonds that we're replacing that are located between the tracks. So to give you a different flavor for the types of things and the devices that are out there. Page 11 takes you to show what the interior on the top of the new fire and intrusion control panel is. That's the main device that is located in the communications room in each one of the stations to provide the fire zoning and notification. It also includes intrusion devices, and we're in the process of completing the last few stations. We'll be back with a closeout package to the board in the next month or so to finish up that contract. The lower right picture is the panel that sits in the kiosk that is available for the station manager to go ahead and use and monitor. Page 12, we're in the process of finishing up the comprehensive radio program. We continue to work on performance issues in the underground system. We've got some antenna issues that we're working our way through in order to get the right level of reception in the underground system. Page 13 starts us onto the mechanical projects. This is a picture on the right of some scaffolding that's been erected to do replacement of standpipes that run from the track level up to the surface so that the fire department, when they come in, can make connections at that point. And it's an extensive process in places where we have deep shafts to scaffold up to do the replacement work. Give you a flavor at the bottom of that page, and what we've included this time in this presentation is the projections for the year for what our work is going to be in place. In this case, we've got 4.5 miles worth of fire line that we're projecting to replace this year, and at the midpoint of the year, we've got about 2 miles replaced. So it gives you a flavor of what we've got on the books to get done this year.
Question on this page.
What's the interval on your standpipe replacement?
It varies, Mr. Smith. It depends upon really the location. If you've got places out on the red line where we've got a lot of water intrusion, they're lasting right at the 20 to 25 year replacement cycle. If you've got areas downtown where you're in a cast-in-place box section where there has not been the type of water infiltration, and if we go to the next slide, it'll show you what happens to the pipe if you're out in the tunnel environment. Where you've got the leak, it increases the corrosion and it deteriorates much quicker. So we've got what would hope to be a 40 to 50 year life cycle in a box section that is underground without the types of leaks. But in a situation like this, we're lucky to get 20 years out of it. What we have done is we've upgraded what we're replacing it with. What originally was black steel pipe that was painted is now hot dip galvanized, so that will give us a much longer life cycle to go ahead and keep the pipe in place.
Okay, could you roll back the previous slide, please?
Sure.
Okay, given the time frames you're talking about and locations, talk to me about the green line and why we're replacing the green line.
The Green Line project is the area that goes under the river, the portion that we're working on right now. It goes between Anacostia back around to Navy Yard. That is a precast tunnel section with bolted liners that are 4 foot in length. It's the same kind of leakage that you see on the next page, only that picture was a picture of a cast-in-place tunnel liner. What has happened in some of the places where we use precast tunnel liners is that the gasket has not held up as well in certain locations. So you get the same kind of leakage that comes out and causes that deterioration and buildup on that. So that's the reason for what would appear to be a very premature replacement in places for some of the pipe on the Green Line. But it is in that area down under the river from Anacostia back around to Navy Yard Station.
Okay, understand. Thank you.
Page number 15. Takes you to some of, again, the backroom pumping systems. The top picture is a drainage pump station. All the water that infiltrates the system is all piped and routed to these locations and then pumped out of the system. The lower picture is a sewage ejector. That's the backroom bathrooms and other discharge areas run to that. And then they're pumped up and out into the sewage system. Page 16 shows some of the work on the mechanical side. This is kind of a close-up picture of the opening slide of what was going to be landed by the helicopter. Page number 17 takes us to hatch replacements, where we have emergency egress hatches at locations between stations. This is a Bilco-type hatch. It is it's a hot-dip galvanized hatch that's spring-loaded. To provide easy egress from this station from the tunnel sections in case of emergency. Lower right are pictures of a damper bank. Those exist basically in the vent shafts at the end of the stations, and then depending upon the type of shaft at intermediate shafts between stations. Page 18 is some environmental projects. This happens to be at Royal. Where we're doing some things on oil-water separators. On page 19, it's the top right picture is a shot of the new onboard fare boxes on the buses. And the lower right picture is the fare vendor machine. We're in the process. You approved last year a program to upgrade 98 fare vendors. We had a target to get 43 of them completed by the end of the year. We met that target. Our next target is to go ahead and get 55 vendors up by the end of March. We, as of this morning, have 15 of those vendors upgraded to accept the debit credit. We also have gone through, and it's not on this slide, a program to get back on both of these and upgrade the software to accept the new $10 bills that were issued today. That has been completed in all of the rail stations and on all the buses. So we're fully prepared to accept the new $10 bills. Page.
Mr. Chairman, when it talks to the new $10 bills, if you can adjust it to take a new 10, could we ever do it to take a 20?
There are a certain number of times that we can upgrade the existing bill validators.
Well, would it be better to update it to take the 20 than to do the new 10? Maybe I'm...
yeah, you have to, there's a process that you have to go through that is a development process that we buy from an outside vendor for that pictorial, if you will, or that graphic for that new bill that's coming out.
Can I translate? Are you asking whether these take $20 bills?
No.
Just the new?
I'm just thinking, as I recall, there was an issue about our machines not taking 20s.
Not taking 20s at all.
At all.
Okay.
So that's definitely been an issue.
So I'm just looking if we can adjust it to accept the new 10 instead of doing, you know, can we do it to take the 20s?
These take $20 bills. It's the Smart Trip machine that doesn't take the $20. The little one that sells the Smart Trip. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different animal, but I've already heard that. I had a station manager tell me that the 20 is the new 10. So.
Yeah,
so that's a different issue. We'll go and look at it, but
okay.
It's not here.
Never mind.
Dangerously close to being quotable, though, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. That's your job. I forgot.
On page 20, we have a rehab program ongoing with parking garages. We'll be completing over the next few months the top right picture, which is the Anacostia parking garage. Lower right is Vienna. That will also be finished about the end of the fiscal year. We've got contracts in place to start on Wheaton and Addison Road. We're working on platforms.
Mr. Chairman, I need to tell you that we don't have that many complaints like we used to get before when we had the party got out.
Yeah.
I don't know if we are likely coincidence or what. Not that many. I hope when you remember on the having that we need something a little bit improved here.
Thank you.
Page 21 shows a shot of the rebuilt wheel truing machine. This is the machine that's located in each one of the major S&I shops that basically puts a train with the wheel set in place over the top of the machine and then turns the wheels back in a completely round shape. It's if you hear the click sometimes it's a flat on the wheels on the train and this brings them back to true. On page 23, we're in the process of going through a major upgrade on the ROC system, our rail operations control system. We're at the point of going to start factory testing of the new software system. We've also got a new rail performance RPM system that we've had several releases and we're going through different phases of development and we're due to release phase 3 by the end of this calendar year. That concludes the portion that I was going to get through and Mr. LaFosse will do the escalator portion next.
We're a little tight on time and we have one more item to do after this that does merit the discussion.
Okay, I'll take you very quickly through the three components of the elevator escalator rehab program. Since the inception, we have completed all 170 of the original entrance units. 8 additional units that were added because of their deterioration. And currently we've completed 3 of the 41 additional units. Pending awards, we have what we call the 20 mini mods. They're Montgomery escalators.
You had something noteworthy there on that last. I just want to make sure that's seen. By the end of this year, over 60% of the 400 escalators that we were rehabilitating will have been done.
Yes.
We're awarded. Okay, not quite done. But it looks like 181 have already been done.
Yep.
And there's some number that are going to be done in the course of this year. So it should be past the halfway mark, I'm guessing.
Yes. The second component is the elevators. And our status there is we have completed 30 of the 95 units scheduled for rehab, and which is equivalent to about... we've completed 30 of the 95 units. We've contracted out another 45, so about 80% of the 95 units are completed or contracted out. The third component is the remote monitoring program. To keep it short, the remote monitoring program is kind of like an ADT program for elevators and escalators. It monitors the status and sends us updates if a unit goes out of service. And currently, we've completed 145 of the 238 elevators and 489 of the 588 escalators. And that concludes my part here. Any questions?
Not at this time. Thank you.
And the last
work.
The last piece here, Mr. Chairman, is Aunt Berger to give you a quick update on our IT performance.
Good morning. First part of this is the standard replacement of our infrastructure, PCs, etc. The server consolidation is a substantial upgrade. We're using essentially virtual servers, load balancing, easier to maintain, much safer. See that note, we can survive a 50% loss of service at a single site. Spam filtering, put in a new spam filter. I remember having multiple conversations with Mr. Deegan and emails, including other board members several weeks ago. We turned it on February the 12th. Since that time, over 1 million emails have tried to enter our system. We have blocked over 75% of them. 68 of those contain viruses, and the number of spams coming through in everybody's main email system is substantially reduced. We just upgraded. The hackers get a lot smarter, and we had an old system, so we just got a better system to block these things. The system runs better. On the ITRP side, on the bus and rail scheduling, 100% of our bus divisions are up, and payrolls be coming out of the trapeze system into the PeopleSoft system, which is a system of record. Rail, we're about 60% done. Greenbelt and Branch will start paying, the first two rail divisions will start paying their people with this new system next week. On the financial side, we have installed about 90% of what's in the program. Got a little bit left to go. That'll be finished by the end of June. On the business systems replacement, we've got payroll up, base HR benefits, and e-recruit, which will automate our recruiting process a lot more efficient and faster. It's scheduled for late April. Triple MS, this is the elephant in the room. This is the material system keyed to preventive maintenance and work orders. We have begun installation. You see the Landover bus maintenance planning, Ellis and Sam's, that's the old systems maintenance. They are operational. We're scheduled to complete this by the end of May. Dave LaCoste just talked about the remote monitoring system. This is called SCADA, and that ties in to MRO, our software program. And every time an elevator goes down now, it automatically, literally within seconds, it hits Triple MS, and a work order is automatically generated. Gives us a lot faster response time. We also feed our intranet and internet sites, giving real-time information on elevator escalator availability.
How long has that been in place, the one that generates the work order like that?
About a month.
That sounds very interesting.
This is the advantage of this new enterprise systems and taking an existing system we have and putting them together in an enterprise to give us much better information, faster information.
It might be useful to have a short piece that explained how that works. And
if you would like that, I'd be happy to provide that.
Let's take a look at some
of that. And in the future, really, the ITRP is scheduled right now for completion in July. There are a few elements of it that will continue past that, but there's no reason to continue ITRP as a separate defined project. It'll be assumed by the ITSD staff. We are developing a five-year plan to further enhance our business systems. A process like this is a beginning more than it is an end. And we are transforming IGSB as quickly as we can to come up with the skill sets and the organizational structure to handle the new enterprise. Scheduled a peer review, CIOs from the District of Columbia, Fairfax County, Montgomery County, and I think we're going to get a state DOT tech expert on March the 10th. And this, by the way, is a no-cost item. The CIOs are helping us out to take a look at where we are, how we're structured, and make suggestions to us on how we can improve the O&M of these facilities. And that's it. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Murfield. This I'll pass Mr. Tangerlini. In a way, it's really too bad that we wind up, because in part this is an information item by its nature, winds up always being late in the agenda, and in part because of its comprehensiveness and its complexity, and in part because of presentation. This perhaps doesn't get the attention it deserves. There's an awful lot of work that this is demonstrating. There's an awful lot of accomplishment here that I think gets lost. And I'm just looking at a few of the things in here that are kind of buried in here. I've recently spoken to other staff I work with in another place and said, I understand why people hide bad news from, elected officials, but it amazes me the amount of time when the good news is buried. Because a lot of people who do the best work and have the most accomplishment aren't really good about telling about it. I think there's a lot here that's really worthwhile and needs to be more widely known. But I'm not sure it comes out always. It's sort of fighting to get its way to get out of a very comprehensive report. I would suggest, since this is a semi-annual report, and I'm anticipating we'll be doing this again in 6 months, can we take a look at ways that we might be able to summarize and bring out some of the things that need to be understood better here. For instance, there's no summary data, which would be valuable. The amount of work here that's involved, there's a lot of stuff here, and highlights. I think with a little different approach to presentation, more people for whom this is not going to be very accessible, there's a lot of technical stuff in here, might get a better appreciation for all that you're actually achieving here. It ought to be noted. And I must say, I really miss Mrs. Hanley, and I know we would never have gotten past page 8 without some remark about stingers being replaced at Metrorail shops. That's just fun. We don't seem to have anymore.
I'll try, Mr. Chairman.
That's a game. Any questions on this presentation?
I just want to underscore the point that you made about summarizing and highlighting good performance and good news. We just don't do that well enough. Even on the performance of the cars, and we did that before you came, Mr. Chairman. The 2000 and 3000, the Royal cars are not performing all that well. We've gotten excellent performance in a year in the other cars, and that's good news. I mean, we all remember the press stories about how poorly the 5000 series cars were performing, and we've got good news to report. And if we don't tell the good news, then certainly nobody else is going to tell it. So. Mr. Zimmerman and I have been, on that theme for a long time. And Mr. Tangerlini, we really want that to happen.
No, I don't disagree with you. And in fact, you'll see as early as the next committee meeting, you'll see that we're going to start moving a little less. We're going to start moving away from this kind of PowerPoint presentation, words on slide, more to giving you kind of executive summaries. And when we need a slide to show a chart or a graph or a photograph, that's when we'll use the slide. We've also talked, and we talked about coming in here today, we talked about ways we could summarize this data better and actually give you something to look at, give you something to see, feel, and touch. There are a lot of interesting, exciting, different elements to this program, and I think we have an opportunity through these discussions to highlight them. One thing I would like to talk to committee chairs about is maybe even, this may sound crazy, but maybe even moving these discussions out of this room and actually to places where the work is being done so you can actually see the work as part of the discussion. So that's something I'd like to speak with the chair about for our next discussion when we'll be talking about bus improvements. There may be an opportunity for us to take it on the road and actually take a look at some of this stuff so you can actually see
it. Very interesting idea.
Yeah. Although,
and I would say, I'm sorry, go ahead, Mr.
Although I do want to make a continued pitch for this board to be involved in action items.
Yes, sir.
And I think the extent to which we are involved in just, you know, freewheeling, brainstorming discussions, you know, should be less. It shouldn't be eliminated, because I think those are important discussions. But we're here as a governing body, and you know, opportunities to go out and view the system and work with and speak to employees and all of that is important. But I think these committees, this is my own, I'm just expressing my own view of this, you know, should as much as possible be focused on decisions that we are going to make. And so, you know, the extent to which that doesn't, you know, this is an ongoing discussion, I know, but I'm just, this is the point of view that I've had, because we've just spent many hours, you know, in freewheeling discussions, you know, through these Thursday mornings, and I think we need to get better focus.
I don't entirely disagree, but I would say that oversight is one of the functions besides decision-making, and so this kind of report is related to essentially the oversight function. We authorized them to do something, we gave them money to do it, and they need to report back to us on what they've done. I think that the way in which that happens can be tightened up, but it is important that we know. And I mean, I spoke about it in terms of, you know, good news often gets lost in here, but I don't mean only for good news. I mean, I want to bring out also where we're coming up short, because that point is, this is an oversight function. So we're seeing, we're really, you know, measuring the mile. You know, we're seeing where are we on our way on a path that we've set, and we need to be able to see that. How are we doing? Just as we do on the operations side when we look at the performance and so on. You know, it's not always something that's a decision today, but it relates to previous decisions we made and also informs future decisions. So I think there is a function. I believe Mr. Deegan was waiting.
Yeah, I just have one quick question. You replaced 200 obsolete PCs. Do we have a policy on replacing them? Do we do it so many years? Or how's that done?
Yeah, the PCs, we have an existing contract with Dell for PCs and peripheral equipment. Generally, we replace the PCs about every 4 years. We keep track of them through the inventory. They're all barcoded, and we have a regular plan to replace PCs to keep them up. I will say that plan is, in my judgment, a little bit looser than it should be. We're working on tightening that up so that we, in fact, can give the best technology for our people on a routine basis. Because what happens is upgrades come out all the time for all of these new systems we have bought on our current systems. And if you don't make sure that you keep up on the infrastructure side, an old PC like a Windows 98 computer will not handle all of these new upgrades, and all of a sudden you look and we say, oh my God, we've got 350 Windows 98 computers out there. Now we have to go out real quick and spend a substantial, call it $1,000 a copy, to replace all these computers and peripherals and so on. Having a little tighter program can avoid that, and we're working on that.
So we have a plan, but not a policy.
Well, no, we have a plan. I'm just pointing out that we're going to improve this and tighten it up a little bit. Your infrastructure needs to be controlled a little bit better to keep everything working smoothly.
And that's why we're sitting down with the CIOs of some of the surrounding jurisdictions to say, hey, what do you think? How can we do this better? What do you do? What mechanisms do you have that we can copy or tag on?
That's a great idea.
All right, thank you very much. We'll see you on this in 6 months.
One more presentation.
Yes, Mr. Graham, did you want to do this next item? Or?
Yes, I've been waiting for it. I'm waiting.
It's not an action item.
Well, we're going to make it an action item. At least I'm going to, I hope to make it an action item.
At a future meeting.
At this meeting, unless.
Oh, so now it's an action item, even though we only advertise an information item.
Yeah, well, I wasn't consulted on how this was put on the agenda. You know, this is my proposal. I would have put it on as an action item. It's a rather benign action item, as you'll see. I'll be glad to make the motion, and you can see how you feel about it.
Yeah, normally I'd like something as it's going to be acted upon to be advertised as such, so people know that in advance. And I didn't remember hearing that you wanted this acted upon at this meeting.
The basic, if I could say, because I think everyone's conscious of the time, the basic thrust of this is that the District of Columbia is interested in having this as a cost reimbursement project fully funded by the District of Columbia. I have consulted with Mrs. Mack, who is very supportive. We met yesterday with the city administrator, who, one way or another, the city is either going to come forward with the money necessary for this project on a pilot basis. I don't want to anticipate the substantive review that we're getting from staff, but this is the thrust of what we want to do here. We're interested in this as a service enhancement for which we are willing to pay for it in FY07.
And that's my, I mean, I understand this to be a reimbursable project for the next fiscal year, which would begin essentially the second half of the fiscal year.
That's right.
Proposing.
So it's a rather benign action item.
Is it not, though, simply part of the budget to be adopted?
Well, this is, you know, it was decided, and I was part of this discussion, that we would start with this committee. Now, I'm chairman of the budget committee, as you know. And we were prepared to move forward at the budget committee, but we decided to come through.
I'm not talking about committee issues. I'm simply asking as a matter of its action. Is it not acted upon ultimately? So this is basically an input then to the...
We're touching base with this committee on our way to the budget committee, on our way to the budget.
Point of order. That's all I'm trying to get is where it ultimately winds up is somewhere in there. The final action is part of the 07 budget.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, my point is on the question of what the rules are in terms of extending service within the system, and the question being, again, whether we extend service in the system on the budget vehicle, and if that's the appropriate way to handle it, and I'd like General Counsel to respond to this, or if there are, in fact, two questions that need to be bifurcated. One is consideration of whether the extension of the services warranted and appropriate, and then secondly, if in fact we're going to pay for it through the budget process, or if it has been conducted in the past and will be conducted in the future, that anyone that wants to extend the system doesn't really need to address the question of extending the system. All you need to do is actually fund it in the budget.
Well, the budget, the mechanism, the district is proposing to pay for this themselves.
Yeah, well, I've seen this movie before. I think it's called Late Night Service. And I've seen exactly how this works in terms of it was a reimbursed function of the District of Columbia to provide late night service, and that got up and running. Not up and running in numbers to our satisfaction necessarily, but then the question of maintaining that service was never a question of purely maintaining that service. The question was put as a language in the budget, which then forces the issue in the concept of the budget as a whole, as opposed to an independent question of whether it's wise or not to extend the service. And my question is, are there two questions at hand in terms of the service and the funding, and are each independent and separable, or, in fact, can service be extended just by putting a line in the budget and therefore service is extended? If council could answer that question.
Mr. Smith, the compact allows the board to establish service without a public hearing. To cut back on service in any significant way, there is a public hearing requirement. So
my question was not about a public hearing.
Well, I'm asking a legal issue.
Okay.
From a legal perspective, yes, the board can go ahead and establish service without, again, a compact public hearing. How it goes about doing that, whether it does it in the budget process as you've outlined or establishes some different procedure, is an entirely discretionary matter for the board.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Graham.
If I may say, I don't think this is a movie that you did see, Mr. Smith, because I think this all began before you became a board member. But you do need to understand that in each segment of the late night service, you know, there was evaluation. There were reports. There was a deadline, you know, whereby the board had to renew it. In each one of those instances. So it wasn't a situation where DC was willing to pay for it, even though the ridership, you know, was distributed. I mean, 37% of the riders in the first and second segment of this came from the state of Maryland. You know, and so there was clearly benefits for the state of Maryland. There was no question about that. But we were willing to pay for it because the state of Maryland was unwilling to pay for it. But in each point of the process, it was very carefully evaluated from an operational point of view and was extended or whatever action was taken. We can reconstruct this for you.
If
Because I think it may have predated your service.
Well, it did not, sir, and I could elaborate on that for you.
I think it did predate your service.
The initiation of it certainly did, but that's not really the point. I think that to add to what Mr. Graham said, though, it was an affirmative decision ultimately to continue the service.
Right.
And, you know,
as part of the budget. It was not an independent decision of the board. It was part of the budget.
Every decision in the budget is an independent decision, and we visit each of them individually.
It's not, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'm sorry, but Maryland didn't have to agree to the late-night service in the budget if Maryland didn't want to.
And we did not. But the budget as an entirety then, is the problem is you proffer these individual items into the budget and force the individual jurisdictions to then either swallow the item as part of the entire budget or not accept the budget as a whole and shut down the entire system. When put in that balance, it's a significant weight against any possibility of objecting to any service in the system.
I submit that nothing would have stopped Maryland from preventing the item from going forward in the budget through our budget process other than the reluctance of Maryland to, in fact, take that action. Because in the end, I don't think it's a service Maryland wanted to oppose once it was in place. But there's nothing stopping anybody from, in any one of many points along the way in the budget, opposing an item, moving to strike it from the budget, and having that done. I mean,
but that can only be done in the context of the committee with the alternates voting and not under the purview of the board as a whole.
Okay. Meanwhile, what we have before us is an information item on a reimbursable project. And obviously, it will have to be dealt with in the budget committee one way or the other, I imagine. So, do we want to hear about the? Do you want to hear about what's being proposed?
I'd like to hear the proposal.
I've read it through. I don't need any more information on it myself.
I do want to respond to something Mr. Graham said. I don't usually disagree with Mr. Graham, but I think this is more than a DC reimbursement project. It's presented as an information item. It just stays as an information item because more information is needed. I mean, we don't have in this presentation the number of cars required to effectuate the service that's being proposed. We don't have any information, although there's a comment here that some cars may be diverted from the blue line. We don't have any information on how that's going to impact the blue line. Look at the ridership from the various lines and see if the blue line customers entitled to better service as opposed to less service. And then we need more information on the headways. How's the additional service going to affect the headways on the green line? I mean, the blue line and the green line, two of the lines that get the less service as currently stand as opposed to now, you're going to make the service even worse. I think there's more information that's needed before we just jump out and do this type of an expansion.
Mr. Chairman, let me just clarify. This the motion that I made, Mr. Solomon, refers to the yellow line. There's an idea floating out there about the blue line, but that's not part of what I'm considering. The blue line split, as it's being called, is you're right, a far more complex proposal. But what I would like us to focus on today is the yellow line.
I understand that, and that's what I was addressing. I wasn't talking about one of the pictures extending the blue line. If you're going to use additional trains on the yellow line, as even if it just goes to the Georgia Avenue, not get to Fort Tarp, where are those trains going to come from? How is it going to affect the headways on the green line? And where are the headways?
Well, a related question is, given that we've got a certain number of rail cars coming in and we're looking to, you know, begin implementing towards a car train, the green line, for instance, is one that clearly needs additional capacity. But if you do this, you need rail cars for it. How does that affect an allocation of cars that we have not yet determined? Because you're going to need some cars for extending the yellow cars.
Tim, like us, take me through quickly. But the quick answer to your question is what we put in front of you, what Mr. Graham was referring to, take it for the next step of the budget committee, is during off-peak, take the yellow line trains, which are now turned back at Mount Vernon.
I've heard that term before somewhere. The turn back.
Yeah. Just keep going, Mr. Solomon.
Take them to Fort Catherine and turn them back. therefore increase.
Only on off-peak.
Well, off-peak, no new rail.
Let's hear the proposal. I mean, this is on the agenda as an information item. Let's hear it.
All right. Let's do so. My first question to you, so. Go ahead, run through it.
Yes. What you have before you is a study which Mr. Hughes and I did, and a couple of our people, and that came as part of, as you recall, back on November the 9th, we had a town hall meeting, and of course Mr. Graham asked for it, and of course Scott Pomeroy represents the Mid-City Business Association, that we sat down and we did a little bit of work on it and tried to explore the different avenues which might get us there. And we did a quick study, and the results of the study is in front of you. For that, couple of scenarios we looked was Green Line train service during midday or late night or the weekends and so on. Then stop in Columbia Heights, and here is the four scenarios which we consider as part of the evaluation. But Jim Hughes will take you through those.
In our time, I'm only going to go to one that is moving forward and people have recommended. It is the third one that is up there. It is an off-peak proposal. Off-peak is described as midday weekdays, night, evening weekdays, and then all day Saturday and Sunday.
So why are you dismissing all the others?
I'm dismissed all the others. We've had a number of go back and forth, including with local communities, and we're just trying to save time. Mr. Graham's proposal that he was trying to bring forward only dealt with number three. I'll go through them all if you want.
Well, all I'm saying is, you know, again, I don't think there's anything wrong with the district being formed for a reimbursable project to extend service in the district, and, you know, that's fine. But there are operational implications, and particularly in terms of other options. And since the rest of us haven't had the opportunity to go through other options that we may or may not be interested in, one of the things we need to know before making a decision on this is what's the implication for the other things that we might be interested in doing. And if you've already ruled them out because you've talked to people, wherever you've talked to them, I don't know who it is, then...
Trying to save time. I apologize.
We should take your reach and discuss with you the pros and cons.
Again, coming into today, I thought this was just the beginning informational discussion. I didn't know we were being asked to act.
Pushing the table for next month. Defer to next month.
Mm-hmm. There's a motion and a second to defer this item to next month's meeting.
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Coffin.
If this proceeds, I would like to, though, ask for some additional information when it comes back, and that would include on the yellow line coming out of the Virginia terminus, how the extended length of service and weekend, non-peak, etc., how that would affect the headway. What does that mean in terms of the gap between trains?
I'll bring that, but it does not affect it, but
okay.
I'll make it clear.
Okay.
And I'll say, just elaborating on what I'd said earlier, I guess we have a motion to defer, and let's find out if that's actually going to happen or not. Maybe I can say something afterwards.
Well, we're deferring it. We're deferring what is at the present time an information item.
Yeah,
since I didn't make the motion, for anything other than
Mr. Smith, was your intention to
defer action, or
for action, or for
becoming
any discussion?
Well, I think it's apparent there's a lot of unanswered questions and coordination involved here. And I would move that we defer the whole issue to the next meeting of the committee.
You mean you don't want anybody to answer any more questions? Or?
Well, I think it's apparent there's a lot of information that's not coordinated and needs to be reconciled before we even get to this point to go through it.
But probably people should put some of their questions out there.
Well, in so much as there's a time between now and the next month's meeting, there's time for individuals to proffer those questions to the staff so they address them in the presentation when it finally comes back to the committee.
I think this is just the way, you know, and we have, I mean, we're typically here in committee meetings until noon. You know, why don't we just...
There is another committee meeting.
Pardon me?
There is another committee meeting.
Yes, I'm well aware of that.
And we have that in 10 minutes, but...
Well, I mean, but
why
can't we proceed to discuss this? What is the point of just, you know...
There's a lack of coordination and information.
Okay, the gentleman can make a motion, so let me just see where people are. Do you wish to continue? Do you wish to vote on the report?
I'd like to continue the information discussion.
Mr. Coffey?
Let's talk about it.
Okay.
Just don't vote with these
things. Okay, I guess that leaves it up to me, and I'm inclined to continue for at least 10 more minutes. Are you willing to hold off on your...
So the vote is 4-3?
I said what that's
saying?
What it is, yeah.
Okay.
All right. I'm with you on the action question, but I think we can have a discussion of it. And I'd like to make a couple of points here in addition to the items we just said in terms of looking at this for what may be future action. Again, I'm interested in the possibility of the extension of service, and I think it should be looked at. In part, this is a way of how you get more capacity out of the system we have right now, and that's a good thing for us to be looking at in a system that's facing growing demands in a region that needs more and not less transit service. But the part that does concern me a little is, what if I pick one and I say that's good, how does it affect other things? And two things that I'm especially interested in terms of where expansion of service within the existing system would go. One is, I'm a lot more interested in extending the line up if north if it goes farther. Frankly, I'm more interested, Fort Tarleton's a great place and I can get some places I want to go, but if I got to College, College Park and maybe Greenbelt, it'd be a lot more valuable for the Virginia side. If you could get on the train and go to the University of Maryland, for instance, a very fine institution, if I may say, that's a destination of some value. I mean, I'm kidding, but literally when I was in graduate school, driving over there every day, I used to think, wouldn't it be great if I get on a train? There is actually a station there now, so you can. But it'd be a lot more valuable if it didn't take, the transfer. So the point is, you increase the connectivity and the value of extension becomes greater. So I'm interested in taking a hard look at that. Whether it's something you do in January 07, I don't know. But I think in the future it's something you're going to look at, and I want to know the implications of one for the other. The other is, again, I don't know how the blue line issue fits into this, but we do have a real fundamental reality in this system that has to get dealt with, which is that, for our side of the river, there's only two places to get across. And while long-term, we may have to think about other places across, that is long-term. And for quite some time, all we're going to have is those two places. And right now, one of the two, the Roslyn portal, we know is overburdened. We're trying to force more through it. We've made a recent policy change to reduce that a little bit, but we're still overburdening it. The other one is basically at half capacity. So I don't know what the best way to do things is, but somehow we got to figure out a way that we use a bridge that's at half capacity so we don't continue jamming up the system because we overuse the other one. I know our concept four, or as I guess it's concept one it was labeled, involves a blue line split, which is something we asked to have looked at quite some time ago. And this really needs to be, we need to know what the answer is here, because again, I don't know how it would affect, one would affect the other between, again, the district proposal. But we are going to have some way to get more of the Virginia traffic going over the Fenwick Bridge. It's just a reality. It won't be able to move enough people from Virginia into the district and vice versa. So I've got to be real comfortable about where we're going with that to understand the implications of what is otherwise by itself, I think, a perfectly reasonable proposal for extension of service.
Does one preclude the other?
Or does it affect it in some way I need to know about? And that's all. Mr. Smith?
Yes, but since we're talking about a multiple lines here and such, I think we really need to look at it with more broad vision of system-wide service, and I certainly hope that the presentation that will come back should also include elimination of the red line turn back at Grosvenor to extend the trains all the way to Shady Grove, because that is certainly a turn back that affects the single most traveled line on the system, the most number of people that ride the trains daily.
Which, of course, is because it's dedicated to just one. You've got the track dedicated to one line. So.
And I think that this proposal should deal with the turn back at Shady Grove and the extension of the red line service in full from Shady Grove to Glenmont, and would like to see that.
Mr. Smith, I don't object to that. It seems to me that's going to be a simple thing to do because it's one piece of track, and I assume it means that it costs so much to do additional operation, you need X number of cars, and probably they can calculate that easily enough, I should think. Is there any complicated, the other ones, it seems to be a complex network problem, but can't you, if we wanted to do what Montgomery County I know would like, we know how to do it, right? It's a matter of figuring out how much it would cost and what the resources.
We've done those estimates. We've done them for both peaks, which does require cars. We've done them for the off-peak similar to this. We say Saturday, done the cost for that. We can bring
so
that
you can present that along with it. Okay, that's fair enough. The discussion is met.
Well, you know, whenever this issue has come up, we are concerned at the near end, on the district side, at the impact of the car loading if that occurs. So that should be part of the analysis as well.
Again, easier to figure with the red line because it's an isolated line. It's a unique situation in our system. Mr. Grant.
Yeah, I'm willing to consider that as well. I mean, if the state of Maryland wants to pay for it, you know, or Montgomery County wants to pay for it, that'd be fine also. But what we're bringing forward here is the District of Columbia wants to pay for it. And you know, and I tell you, I know this becomes a little bit of tension because we're running up against some fundamental issues in this system. And for me, my eighth year on this board, and I long ago realized that the basic purpose of this system as it was historically structured was to bring people in from the suburbs, to center city to their jobs, and to take them home at night. So what this type of proposal, as was the New York Avenue infill station, is a request by the District of Columbia for increased relevance. We're not saying it's irrelevant, but for increased relevance to the people who live in the District of Columbia. And it so happens that on this particular line, you know, there is a very clear case that can be made for a service enhancement at a very low cost, where we get a lot of bang for our bucks. And that, coupled with the fact that the District of Columbia government is willing to pay for it and has the means to pay for it, and assuming no further adverse impacts on our system, meaning that it's good news, good news, good news, makes a pretty clear case for this. I mean, we just want a service enhancement. We see the service enhancement as very relevant to our lives. You know, we're not saying it isn't relevant to others because this helps the state of Virginia. It, in fact, helps the state of Maryland because we're going right out there as well. It helps National Airport because we now would have a direct connect from Center City to National Airport, which is surely relevant to those people who want to get on a plane. You know, everywhere you look at this, it makes sense. Now, if we weren't willing to pay for it, you'd say, well, you'd have some grousing, well. But since this is a gift from the people of the District of Columbia in terms of their tax dollars, you know, it just seemed to me to be something that was very much recommended. Now, if there are other things we should consider, and of other jurisdictions, for example, I agree with you, Mr. Zimmerman, if the state of Maryland wishes to extend this to Greenbelt, all the more attractive. I mean, and if they want to pitch in with the funding to take it to Greenbelt, you know, I think it makes sense to do that. But this is the area in which we could act, in which we're willing to act. And so I see it as a very positive thing.
Further discussion? We look forward to seeing this item brought back again and to more analysis on these issues. I'm sure if members have other questions or other concerns, they'll communicate them directly with the chair. At the conclusion of this meeting, the Real Estate Committee will be meeting in executive session. I move that the committee meet in closed session to discuss contractual matters consistent with Board Procedure Roman numeral 6.4. Is there a second? Second by Mr. Solomon. All in favor, please say aye. Opposed? That motion carries. Ms. Mack.
I am going to ask for consideration of moving the budget committee, which is now scheduled for the fourth Thursday, which is now scheduled for the 23rd of March, to move that committee meeting to the 16th of March because the Customer Service and Operations Committee is canceled. That would free us on the 23rd from meeting. I would ask staff to consider that, and if there is no complication, I'd like to see us move that committee.
Okay, so the suggestion is no operations committee will be held on the 16th, therefore we could move budget to before the board meeting on that day.
That's correct.
We'll probably have to meet at 9, though.
Exactly.
About 9:30.
Exactly.
And then you could be free on the 23rd.
Exactly.
And you promised that we won't have a special budget meeting.
I promise that we won't have a special, unless the chairman calls for it, and I don't think he will.
So that would be, Mr. Tagliani, is that understood what Max suggested?
Chairman, I'd like to bring something to your attention.
Oh, hold on, let me finish with it.
Does it have to do with the schedule?
We can do that, I think, Mrs. Mack. Chuck and I talked earlier. I haven't had a chance to talk to Dan, so I apologize for my focus. If you'd be a little relaxed on making the actual mail out, because the capital program is going to take a lot of work. The second piece about that is the JCC report is beyond our control, so I don't know if they can move your out every several week or not.
Well, what I would suggest is that you take a look at that. And
we'll be looked at, and then we'll get an answer back. Right?
Exactly, okay. Right. And
you'll
we'll try to make some arrangements.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now we will attempt to free up the 23rd.
May I be recognized for one more second for a non-germane comment, but I think very important one. This is Mr. Bartlett's last committee meeting. I think he should be recognized.
And while we're speaking about it, Mr. Bartlett, let me just say that at a cocktail reception to recognize Black History Month, Mr. Bartlett was recognized and honored at that reception, and it was for his contribution to cocktail, so very well deserved. Thank you.
All right. We are adjourned.